The death of Achav and the death of Eliyahu mark the end of a certain period in the history of the Northern Kingdom. And we now come to the last 100 years of the Northern Kingdom, of the tribes of Israel. The destruction of the Northern Kingdom and the exile of the 10 tribes to a far distant place from which they have never returned. The chief architect of the rebellion was Jehu, who succeeded to the throne. And like most rebels, he began with the highest of motives and with the greatest of ideals. But the successful revolution always runs into the problems of being successful. And Jehu's revolution was no different. After destroying the family of Achav, Jehoram Achav's son, Izebel Achav's widow, and after uprooting the idols and driving out the Canaanite and Phoenician gods, Jehu himself succumbs to the corruption of power, and Jehu himself succumbs to the problems of the surrounding society. And the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, was never in its history able to uproot paganism from its midst. And that really is the reason why it collapsed. Because paganism is not something to be seen in a vacuum. There are other things that come with it. Immorality comes with it, sexual immorality, a great deal of social strife, a great deal of difference in classes. Paganism never was democratic. You can see that in the world today, in India and Japan and other basically pagan countries. The structures are very rigid. The caste system is very strong. Very difficult to put an eclectic, democratic system into being. And these are the things that undid, that destroyed the Northern Kingdom. We hear it in the words of the prophets. The two main prophets who prophesy the destruction of the Northern Kingdom are Hoshea ben Be'eri, who was a man of Judah who came north and lived amongst the 10 tribes, and the famous prophet Amos, who was a shepherd in the city, from the city of Tekoa. And their message was the fact that it was an unjust society. It was a corrupt society. It was a society that exploited, that cared not for human beings. It was a society of things and not people. It had lost touch with its Torah roots, and that was because of all of the years of paganism, all of the years of alien influences. And the Jewish people never returned in time. They never were able to catch it in time to be able to return and become whole again. And the Novi, in his famous statement, says, "Al shlosho pishe Yisrael val arbo lo ashivenu," that God, so to speak, has forgiven the Northern Kingdom 3 times, the 3 dynasties which existed, all their evil, but now the 4th time he will not forgive it any longer. And the 4th crime is Al Nichrom Bakesef Tzadik, the righteous are sold for money, the Evyon Bavur Na Aloyim, and the poor man is sold out for a pair of shoes, which is the symbol of things over people. A pair of shoes is worth more than a poor man. That's a terrible indictment of society. And a society such as that eventually is doomed. The Jewish society is doomed sooner than the general society. But even a general society is doomed, because it can't exist. And sooner or later, the imbalance becomes so great that the society cannot carry it any longer. The weight of the injustice eventually overwhelms the society. Now, the picture of what happened has to be seen in the political and diplomatic nature of the time. You have in the northern part of the Middle East, in this part, you have three main empires vying for supremacy. The northern tribes, the empire that Ahav and that his father Omri had built, very powerful country, which even though it's so powerful is on the brink of total extinction. Because in the history of the world, countries are snuffed out, you know, like you turn out the light. All, you know, all of a sudden it's there, and then you hit the switch and goodbye. I often feel from my readings that if someone would, from the turn of the century, would be brought today to see what the world looks like today, let's say he saw the world before World War I, which was still 75 years ago, and it would be just unfathomable. It would be, no one would believe it. Where's England? Where's France? Where's Prussia? Where's the Habsburg Empire? Where are the Tsars? Where is everybody? I invited people to a parlor meeting at my home. So there's some people that came on the wrong date. Came a week early. So he said, where is everybody? I said, you know, you can leave your money anyway. It's the difference. This Monday, next Monday, it's the same thing. But where is everybody? It's like you showed up at the wrong time. Where is everybody? But since we have lived through it, so to us it's natural, it's historic. We can, you know, we write books about it, you read it, you know what happened. But how did it happen? Just unbelievable. Unbelievable that such things could have happened. And here also, you're a century before the disappearance of the northern tribes, and they are one of the strongest countries. The second country is Aram, the country of Syria, Damascus, and the third country is Ashur, the Assyrian Empire. Now you have three countries, everybody vying to beat the other guy out. And then you have one little country, which is Yehuda, the southern kingdom of Judah. So it depends how you put it together. Sometimes Aram and Ashur are together against Yisrael and Yehuda. Sometimes Aram and Yisrael are together against Ashur. Sometimes Ashur and Yehuda are together against Yisrael. It's just wild. And this goes on for the entire century. Under certain kings, the alliances are such, and under then their successors, the alliances change. It's a little like the Arab world today. And you literally cannot tell the players without a scorecard. You don't realize what's happening. So again, if you look at it as history, it's history, right? But it's really God stirring the pot. And the pot is going to boil over. And when it boils over, it's the Jewish people that are going to be destroyed. When Yehu dies in the year 814 before the Common Era, so his son Jehoahaz becomes the king. When Jehoahaz becomes the king, there is a precipitous decline in the fortunes of the northern kingdom. Aram waxes extremely powerful. And it became the major empire. And Israel became enslaved literally as a vassal state. It says in Malachim, that no one was left with Jehoahaz. They disarmed his army. They left him with 50 cavalrymen and 10 chariots, which you can't do much with. That was just like the king's retinue, the king's guard. The rest of the army was completely disarmed. Israel was not allowed to have an army. And Aram controlled. Aram had a great general who was the spearhead of its great victory. And his name was Naaman. And Naaman was afflicted one day with leprosy. And he tried every cure in the world until finally the Tanakh tells us that he had a maidservant in his house who was a Jewish child that was stolen in one of the marauding raids across the border. Sounds familiar. And she said, well, why don't you go see Elisha, go see the prophet Elisha. He'll be able to cure you. The king of Aram, who's the great emperor, sends a message to the king of Israel, who is his vassal, and he says, I'm sending you my famous general Naaman. You know, you've got the Nobel Prize winning doctor, prophet, you know, Elisha there. And you take care of him. Make sure you cure him. So the non-Jew believes that Elisha can cure him. The Jewish king says, what am I going to do now? He's going to send me Naaman. Nothing's going to happen. And he'll kill me. He doesn't believe in Elisha. He can't afford to believe in Elisha, because if you believe that Elisha can cure the leper, then you have to believe the rest of Elisha also. And the rest of Elisha has hard things to say to Jehoahaz. And therefore, it's easier not to believe at all. Even though it may be in your best interest to believe, but it's very hard to give up policy and wealth and position. It's very hard. It's part of the great problem that afflicts the Jewish people today. It's hard to give up 200 years of lies, even though we all know it's lies. But it has an infrastructure. It's jobs and money and politics and power. You just can't walk away from it. And it takes an earthquake to shake it. So Naaman comes to Elisha. Elisha gives him what we would politely say is the cold shoulder. You have to remember that Naaman is, maybe he's not Himmler, but he's certainly Kesselring or von Rundstedt. He doesn't even go out to see him. He doesn't welcome him in the foyer. He sends out his messenger and says, go take a bath in the Jordan River 7 times. That'll cure you. Naaman is just insulted. He is furious. The insult. The man of God didn't even come out to see him. He didn't show him any protocol. They didn't have what today we would call a photo opportunity. Nothing. And he sends out this, you know, sends out his servant, and they tell him, and he says, what, am I missing rivers in Aram? You know, I've got greater rivers, right? The Hudson's a bigger river than the Jordan. I always have that feeling when I cross the Hudson at the Tappan Zee, aside from paying the dollar and a half, the feeling that I have, I mean, that's a river, you know, you cross the Jordan, you can leap over it. That's the Great Jordan. There's a river. Or the Mississippi at St. Louis, or the Missouri, or the Yellowstone. I mean, those are rivers. That's what Naaman says. What, he sends me to take a bath in the river, in that little river. It's not nice of me, but one of the funniest things ever happened to me in my life was that I was, when 1967, when my wife and I went for our first tour of the Holy Land, and we went on our own, which was very interesting also. So we used to schnorr tours every day. You know, we'd attach ourselves to different tours to find out where we were at. So one day we were with a Christian tour, non-Jewish tour. They took us to Capernaum and a few other places near the Jordan. And then they took us, then the guide, who was very good, he took us down, took them down to the river, and they were all filling up bottles with holy water from the Jordan River. And I turned around, and I saw about 100 yards upstream, there was an Arab relieving himself in the river, which can give one pause. Right, but that's, you know, I can't think of the Jordan anymore without seeing that, that vignette in front of my eyes. So that's what Naaman says when I'm going to go. Who knows? Why? That's crazy. But on the way home, his servants say to him, "Listen, what do you got to lose? Leprosy you got, right? We know that God forbid if someone is ill, Rahman al-Islam, no one should know that there's no limit to what a person will try to cure himself. You can convince a person of anything. He'll drink the bitterest medicines, he'll go on the worst nutritional diet, he'll torture himself, anything. Wants to be cured. So he says, "I'll go take a bath in the river. What do you care?" He does, and he's cured. Cured, he's a different man. Our rabbis tell us he converts, he becomes a Ger Toshev. He believes in Elisha. He sees the greatness of the God of Israel. The Jews, they think he's crazy. Something happened to him. Because Elisha is there for, they all know Elisha. They know he can revive the dead. They know all the stories, they know. But it's got nothing to do with them, right? Nobody's going to close his store on Saturday because Elisha can revive the dead next door. One thing has nothing to do with the other. Jews have that capability. The Jewish people are schizophrenic beyond belief. But Naaman, who is not Jewish, so he takes it very seriously. And Elisha cured him. So he wants to reward Elisha. He wants to pay the bill. So he says to him, I'll pay you, not for yourself, take for your yeshiva, right? Take for your institution. He had gold and silver and diamonds. There's no shortage of what he has. And Elisha knows, he learned the lesson from his father Abraham, that the moment you take, you're gone. Chazal always posed for us the dichotomy in life, that Jews are supposed to support and help and give to Talmidei Chachomim, and the Talmidei Chachomim are always supposed to refuse and not take. How that works in practice is very hard to draw that line. But there is a line. And Elisha is not going to take a penny from him. But Elisha has a servant, Gehazi. And Gehazi says, the old man's out of his mind. We got here, Rockefeller just converted. And he wants, we can build the world, and he's letting them go. I always say in my heart of hearts that Gehazi was the executive director. He couldn't let him go, right? He couldn't let the fish get off the hook. So he chased him. And he said, my master changed his mind. He thought it over, changed his mind. We'll be happy to accept your donation. Naaman's happy to give it. Naaman's donation has leprosy with it. Gehazi takes it and he becomes the leper. A tremendous lesson in that. The old Jewish joke that Myron Cohen tells about Klotman's diamond, right? That with the diamond comes Mr. Klotman. Well, with the money comes leprosy. You don't get money free this time around. No such thing as free. Elisha didn't want to take it because he knew that there's a problem with it. Can't exist with it. But Gehazi takes it. But it makes a tremendous impression that Naaman becomes a convert. though officially he's still bound to the court ritual in the capital of Aram. But we see from that entire incident how Israel was subservient to Aram. It was not an independent country at all. And what happened was that B'nai Ammon and Edom and all the other surrounding countries, it's like jackals falling on an antelope or on a deer that can no longer run swiftly. So everybody tears it apart. So we read in Amos and in the other prophets of the fact that the country is ripped apart by all of these other surrounding nations. Everybody takes off their bite. So what happens? God gives the Jewish people a second chance. Not a second chance, a 42nd chance. Ashur, from nowhere, the empire of Assyria rises and smites Aram a tremendous blow that Aram is not prepared for. They're fighting in the south, and all of a sudden in the north, this tremendous invasion occurs, all right? Iran and Iraq, that war has been going on for, people think it's 7 years old, it's 10 years old. Yeah, how would you like 2,600, 2,700 years? That's a lot closer. If people would see it in that, the State Department would see it in that light, they would be less sanguine about their ability to deal with the matter. Just like the Israeli-Arab struggle, you know, everybody's got a plan. He's going to have a conference, he's going to say, these things have been going on, the Israeli-Arab thing has been going on since Isaac and Yishmael. Didn't start today. And all the superficial things that you see are not the issue. And therefore, it's very difficult to say that it's given to any easy amelioration, any easy settlement. We have the magic formula. And these things, there are no magic formulas. What happened now was that when Jehoahaz died, his son Jehoash became the king. When Jehoash became the king, he reconquered most of the territory that was lost to Aram, because Aram now was weakened by Ashur. So Yisrael had a rebirth. And this is about the year 785 before the Common Era, about 60 years before the end of the northern tribes. So 60 years before, they have a tremendous rebirth of strength, of military power, of empire again. And he is able to push the borders to where they were at the time of Ahav. So that Aram, which was the major empire 5 years before, now is squeezed like by a nutcracker. It's held in a vise between Yisrael on one side and between Ashur on the other side. Elisha is still alive, and Elisha prophesies, and he says, Chetz Tshua LaHashem, Chetz Tshua Barom. The arrow of victory God sends now to Israel, the arrow of victory that will pierce the heart of Aram. Now is your opportunity, and it was the opportunity. What happens is they win the war and they lose the opportunity. We are accustomed to that, unfortunately. Because what happened is they should have restructured their society. They should have given up on the old pagan ways that brought them to destruction. Should have listened to the old Navi. But it didn't happen. Concurrently, because it's like this, all of Jewish history is a three-ring circus going on at once. You don't know what to watch it. At the same time, but concurrently at the same time, you have tremendous problems in the southern kingdom in Yehuda. When Ahaziah the king died in about 840 before the Common Era, so his mother Ataliah grabbed power, and his mother was from the family of Ahav, and she was a Phoenician princess, and she was determined to eradicate Judaism from the Jewish people. It's important to know all of these stories, just as it's important to know the stories in the Second Temple, because you see what the Jewish people have survived. And you see that no matter how bad things are, they've been worse. You also see that we survived it all, and that Torah survived it all, and that there still is a Jewish people, which is the basic optimistic story of Jewish history. Otherwise, it's terribly depressing. Even with good jokes, it's terribly depressing. She killed out the entire royal family of David to guarantee that there would be no survivors except the little child Jehoash, who was Ahaziah's youngest brother. He was hidden in the apartment of the high priest, and he was raised by the high priest, by Jehoiada. And when the time came, Jehoiada and the priests made a rebellion against Ataliah, against her pagan ways and her despotism and her cruelty, and she was killed. And Jehoash, who was 7 years old, was made king. And Jehoiada, the high priest, became the regent, until such time as Jehoash would grow older and assume the role of king himself. For the first time in Jewish history, you have the priesthood, the Kohanim, and the kingdom, the line between them blurs. And from now on, that's going to be a problem. Because the kings, once you've tasted power, it's very hard to relinquish it. Once the Kohanim felt that they had something to say in the government, so then they always wanted to say something in the government. And we'll see that the kings, in order to reestablish themselves, encroached upon the Kohanim, until finally at the reign of Uzziahu, the grandson of Jehoash, he actually tries to perform the service of the high priest in the temple and is struck down by leprosy. So there's a line here. And in the latter part of the first temple, the line was violated. In the second temple, it was eliminated. The Hashmonaim, who were Kohanim, were kings, and they were the high priests at the same time. And that was the source of great disputation, revolution, civil war among the Jews. Couldn't keep the line straight anymore. Now, Jehoash was one of the righteous kings. And because he was raised by Jehoiada, the high priest, Jehoash set out to reform the country in the most positive form possible. We read that he rebuilt the temple because the temple had fallen into disrepair. We also read that the Kohanim in his time were unfortunately corrupt, and the monies that were raised never, it was a little like some of the government programs, the monies never got to where they were supposed to go. And he instituted a system that cleaned up the kahuna, so to speak. He destroyed the idols in the country. He removed idolatry. He instituted, again, the pristine form of Jewish education. He raised the level of the poor. He brought on a sense of social justice. He was a great and wise person. However, what happened was that Aram, which at that time was the dominant empire, as I discussed with you before, Aram, after controlling the northern kingdom, now came south and effectively controlled the southern kingdom as well. And Aram was behind the assassination of Jehoash. because they felt him to be a danger to them. And he was assassinated by two of his servants, as we read in Tanakh. And he was succeeded by his son Amatzio. Amatzio, according to many, is the father of the great prophet Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu was from the royal family. He's called Yeshayahu ben Omotz, but many of the Mephorshim say that Omotz and Amatzio are the same person. Now, during the time of Amatzio, there was a civil war between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom, which now threw off the yoke of Aram and became a power, so instead of uniting with their brethren in the south, instead of doing away with the paganism, instead of returning to the temple in Jerusalem, they had illusions of grandeur. They besieged the city of Jerusalem, and they killed Amatzio in the war of the Jews. I'm sorry, I don't mean they killed him. They captured him and held him as a hostage, and then eventually released him. But they had him assassinated later. So you have here a terrible history of political assassination. And after he was assassinated, then his son Azariah, who is called Uzziahu, King Uzziahu, became the king. He was the brother of the Novi Yeshayahu, the older brother. Now, I mentioned to you that Uzziahu was the king a long time. Uzziahu was a righteous king. But Uzziahu was determined to reestablish the primacy of the king over the Kohen to the extent that he invaded the temple. And he attempted to bring the Ktores to burn the incense on the altar himself, something that was reserved only for the high priest of Israel. So the Tanakh describes for us that what happened was that when he attempted to do so, an earthquake occurred. A tremendous earthquake, and that he was struck as a leper. And we find this in Tanakh. Everything in that period of time is measured by this event. Shnosayim lifnei arash, 2 years before the earthquake happened, years after it happened. It was the year zero. It was the event by which the society measured time. And Uzziahu, because he was a leper, even though he lived, he had to abdicate to his son, Yosam. And it's a tragedy, because he was a great person who could have done a great deal. Now what happens is that the two countries patch it up between themselves, and they now unite to resist the comeback of Aram. Aram, that had been squeezed between Ashur on the north and Yisrael on the south, is able to revive itself. A cyclical type of arrangement here that, this year the country is in and this year it's out. They were able to revive themselves. And what happened was that the new king of Israel, Yerovam, the second Yerovam, he is able to withstand the first attack of Aram, but not the second. And the second attack of Aram, and this is in about the year 760 before the Common Era, about 40 years before the end of the Northern Kingdom, the second attack of Aram takes into exile all the Jews that lived in the Golan and in Bashan and in Gilad, which is the northern part of what is today the country of Jordan. In that area lived the 2.5 tribes, the tribes of Reuven and the tribes of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. They had lived there under a compact that they had made with Moshe, that's recorded for us in the Chumash. But they were the first tribes to go into exile. They went before the other 7.5 tribes. And our rabbis saw in that the significance because of the fact that when the Jewish people needed them, they came up with a counter offer that they were going to stay east of the Jordan. They said to Moshe, Al no tavirenu es hayarden, don't make us go west of the Jordan. They weakened Jewish resolve. And therefore, even though they lived up to the words of their bargain was that they would be the scouts, they would be the frontline troops, they would sacrifice, they would do everything, they lived up to it, it could not remove the blemish that when at the moment of test, at the moment of trial, they were found wanting. And therefore they went into exile before any of the other tribes. And they were taken away we know not where. And that important section of the country was lost to Aram. When it was lost to Aram, Aram now surrounded the kingdom of Israel. It was on the west because it controlled the Phoenician ports all the way south, even south of Haifa to what is today Caesarea. It was on the north, it was Lebanon and Syria, and it was also on the east in the northern part of Jordan. And Israel found itself in a very weakened position. It was outflanked militarily, and Aram again became very, very strong. What happened also was that by now the social structure in the northern kingdom was such that the poor people were impoverished. The poor people lived in famine no matter what the crop was. And the amount of extortion, the amount of economic duress that existed was of such a nature that the country was near collapse. And Yerovam did not take any steps to correct it, even though the prophets warned him. He did not want to buck the landed class, the wealthy class, what we would call the real estate lobby, whatever. And the great surge of empire and prosperity ended during his reign. From now on, it's going to be downhill. If you read the prophecy of Amos, which is some of the most beautiful and poignant and strongest language in the Tanakh, you have a good picture of the time. You have a good picture of the injustice of what the Navi cries out about. He says, woe to those that sit at ease in Zion and think that nothing's going to happen to them, which is the way people always feel. Before the storm, everybody feels that they're safe. Right, October 18th, everybody was in good shape. Well, if you'll multiply that in a much more serious vein, you'll see what we're talking about. So in the northern kingdom, it was going down. In the southern kingdom, Yosam attempted to strengthen his reign. But he also was unable to do so. When Yerovam died in the year 748 before the Common Era, his son Zechariah was only a king for 6 months. And then he was overthrown by a coup, one of the army generals in the north. He was killed. And the new king was a man called Sholom ben Yovesh. And he was the king for 30 days. You've heard a queen for a day. Well, this is like king for a month in the northern kingdom. And then Menachem ben Gedi took over, who overthrew him. And now what happens is that we're talking about chaos. You're talking about no government. You're talking about ruling bands and brigands. The Jewish people become ungovernable. at this time, Aram has a new idea. It installs a puppet king in Israel, whose name is Phekach ben Remaliahu. And Phekach and Aram go to make war against Yehuda, against Jerusalem. And their intent is to put to kill out the house of David, and to put a puppet ruler, somebody by the name of Ben Toval, whom we know very little about. Many say he was a sheik who lived east of the Jordan. Some say he was not even Jewish. But to install him as the ruler in Judea, in the southern part. And we read already in the Navi Yeshayahu how the Jewish people trembled, the southern kingdom trembled at the approach of Aram and the approach of the army of Yisrael to come and attempt to install the new king and destroy the house of David. They were unable to do so. The Navi tells the king not to fear Shnei Zanvo Saudi Moele. He says, don't be afraid of these two burned out fires. They're has-beens. They're washed up. Forget about Aram. Forget about Yisrael. You concentrate on being the Jewish king. You concentrate on the Jewish community. Don't make the mistakes that the northern kingdom is making. That, in effect, is the message of the Navi. And the kings of Judah generally listened to the Nevi'im, much more so than the northern kings. In the middle of all of this, Ashur makes the comeback. And this time, it's the final comeback. Aram is going to be destroyed. It never again will be a major power. It was like coming to Jerusalem was its last shot. It overreached itself. There's a limit to countries, and there's and usually the limit is reached with the Jewish people. And the end of Spain is the Jewish people, the end of the Tsar is the Jewish people. There are limits. The Austrian Empire, others, British Empire. The Jewish people are a shortcut to success, but it's a hard nut to swallow. And Aram overreached itself. It overreached itself by attempting to take over Jerusalem, by destroying the house of David. And Ashur now rises like a lion. Now, if you are ever in the British Museum, which I hope someday that you'll have a chance to visit, you'll see that the British in their fashion took the gates of Nineveh home with them and have installed them in the British Museum. And you can see the winged horses of the Assyrians, their symbols. You can see Tigranes-Pileser, the first great emperor of Ashur. You can see his likeness and that of his son. You can see a picture of Sargon, who was the king that destroyed the northern 10 tribes and who is called Sancheriv. Many of the Mefarshim say he was called Sancheriv from the word Churban, because he was the wind of Churban. The Jews called him that. Even though he had his official name was a different name, but it made no difference what his official name is. He's known to the world ever since as Sancheriv. And Ashur rises with a mighty roar, and it simply overwhelms Aram. Babylonia overwhelms Syria, overwhelms the entire empire. So this 150, 200-year struggle between these two titans ends. And by the year 730, Ashur is the dominant empire. And Ashur is not benevolent. It was never known for being a benevolent empire. It was never known for any characteristics of tolerance or mercy. And in fact, Ashur's policy was that any country it conquered, it removed the indigenous population from that country. It forced them to move. They didn't have a refugee problem. They didn't have problems of minorities. They didn't have any of those problems. They moved everybody out. And they sent them all somewhere else, and they imported other people to come in. And their policy and purpose in so doing was that the new population would not have any attachment to the country. They would be strangers in a strange land, and therefore much less likely to rebel, a much more docile population, people who could be exploited more easily, and could be governed relatively in an easy fashion, without too much trouble. Of course, this is a ruthless, cruel, bitter policy. But it was the policy of Ashur. And that policy reflected itself very, very strongly vis-a-vis the Jewish people, as we will see in a few moments. Now, by the year 730, Ritzin, the king of Aram, was killed, and all of the administrative officers, etc., of Aram were all executed, and Ashur took everything over. We read that the Ashur, as punishment for what the Jews did, exiled the first 13,000 Jews. It doesn't say where they took them, but 13,000 Jews were exiled. And then what Ashur did was slowly constrict the borders of the northern kingdom. They took them out of the upper Galilee completely. They forced them down into the lower Galilee. Eventually, they left them only in the enclave of Shomron, of Samaria, so that you had a small Jewish population with completely indefensible borders in the grip of a mighty empire. It is estimated that 40 to 50,000 Jews were killed during this war, during this slow constriction of the northern kingdom. And the Jews were defenseless. Not only were the Jews defenseless, the Jews in the south were also defenseless. And we will see that the Jews in the south are as afraid of Ashur as the Jews were in the north. And in fact, they are saved only by divine intervention. The strength of Ashur was such that the Jews really made no attempt to defend themselves. And finally, there are difference of opinion in the date. It's either 722 or 732 before the Common Era. There's a 10-year discrepancy. Most scholars say 722. But in that year, Tiglath-Pileser, Sargon, Sancheriv came against Shomron, and he starved it out. The walls collapsed. He slew the population, and he took all of the Jews that were left in the northern part of the country and moved them, took them away. Again, where the 10 tribes went, we have no idea. Jewish legend has placed them behind the magical river Sambatyon, a river that throws stones all week. And on Shabbos it rests, but on Shabbos they cannot cross the river because of the laws of Shabbos. And in Jewish legend, the 10 tribes have always lived. The river has always been real. During the Middle Ages, we have a number of incidents of people who came and said they were representatives of the 10 tribes. Some were out and out charlatans. Others believed it on themselves. But what happened to the 10 tribes? So the Japanese say they're the 10 tribes, and the British say they're the 10 tribes, and the American Indians say it could be that all of them are. Funny-looking cousins. But stranger things have happened in God's world. There's a tribe of Indians in Tennessee who are related to the Seminole Indians from Florida, who every fall sit in booths and take palm fronds and citrus fruit and perform rituals with it. Could be that the Estrogim sellers got to them in the 15th century. That also could be. A lot of things can be. But it's a strange world. And it's a mysterious world. And even if you buy all of the tapes of this series, there will be things that you will not know. And God is not, you know, we have to wait for the video, I imagine. The recordings that we have from the both from the Tanakh and from the records of the Assyrians, which were on the walls of Nineveh, is that in the triumphal parade of captives in Nineveh, over 27,000 Jews were brought from the northern kingdom to participate in the triumph, in the parade that marked the destruction of the Jewish state and the victory march of Sanherith. All of them have disappeared. And according to the majority opinion in the Talmud, they are not coming back. But according to Jewish tradition, Jewish legend, sometimes the Jewish people will things that cannot be, but because we will it, it is. According to the will of the Jewish people, they will come back. We'll see them yet. Sanherib is not satisfied with the northern kingdom. First of all, what he does is he imports a new people to live there. Took all the Jews out. He filled the country up with people whom he brought from Crete, from the island of Crete, and also from the island of Cyprus. And they were called Kutim, from which was the name, and they were also called Shomronim, people of Samaria, the Samaritans, who later built hospitals. They were pagans. They came into the country with their gods. They were taken. It's a little like the penal colonies that founded Australia. And they came there, and it was a new country for them. And all the indigenous inhabitants were gone. And they found only waste and desolation and fright. So they brought with them their pagan gods, the gods that they had had in Crete, in Greece and in Crete and in Cyprus. And they worshiped these gods. And what happened was that a plague of lions overtook them. Wild lions. There were, in the time of the Bible, the lion roamed throughout the Middle East and throughout Israel. We find them in the Tanakh many times. David and Samson, the lion was very common. And the lions all of a sudden became ferocious man-eaters. Lions usually don't eat people. Unless terribly provoked, etc. I mean, they're not interested in you. But this plague of lions overcame them. So they had a meeting and they said it must be, which is a great, typically pagan idea, the god of this country doesn't like the gods that we brought, because every country's got its own god. And therefore, we're going to give up on the old gods, on the Greek gods, and we'll try this God. This God was the Jewish God. So this God said, there are no other gods. Okay. We'll give it a chance. And they converted. They circumcised themselves. They converted. They adopted Jewish customs and mitzvahs. Our rabbis say not only that, that whatever they adopted, they were much more scrupulous in observing than Jews themselves. A fact that is not unknown in Jewish history. The Talmud says that you can eat the matzah of the Shomronim. If they give you a piece of matzah, you don't have to worry about the chametz. That's because it wasn't machine made. The matzah, other mitzvahs, kol mitzvah she'erziku bo kusim, mitzvahs that the kusim observed, you could trust them implicitly. But they weren't Jewish. And they reverted back eventually to paganism. And their commitment, their rabbis call it gerei arroyos, they became converts because of the lions. That's not a good enough reason. It doesn't stand the test of time. There have been tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of converts to the Jewish people over its long history. Most of them have stood the test of time because their reasons for converting were legitimate and their commitment was firm and deep. But the Shomronim had a different commitment. You can still see them today, or their descendants today, on the mountain of Gerizim outside of Shechem. There are about 75 Samaritan families left. They were the ones that Sancheiriv brought. He imported them. Yeah. Now, Sancheiriv went south and he attempted to conquer Jerusalem. This is already during the reign of the great king Chizkiyahu, the son of Ochoz, the grandson of Yosam. And when they came south to Jerusalem, the city almost collapsed because they had no army to speak of that would be able to overwhelm Nineveh and overwhelm the Assyrian Empire. But on the night of Pesach, in the year 720, on the night of the first Seder, the army of Sancheiriv was destroyed by a plague. And they fled in chaos and confusion. And that chaos and confusion not only was a defeat as far as Asher was concerned, but it was a defeat that would bring about the beginning of the end. Because right around the corner, there's a new bully that's getting ready to come on the scene, and that's Babel, the Babylonian Empire. And they, the Chaldeans and the Babylonians, these two tribes, they're getting ready for the next onslaught. And Asher also overreached itself. And it overreached itself where? Again in Jerusalem. He went too far. And he had conquered everything else. He had conquered the north. He had reached Egypt. He had done everything, everything that he needed. He overreached himself. And in overreaching himself, he risked everything. And the Lord interfered with his plans. We have a poem that we recite on the Seder night, and we also recite it according to those that say piyut in the morning in Shacharis, the poem Vayhi b'chatzi alayla. It was in the middle of the night. And there in the poem are recited numerous miracles which happened on the night of Passover, on the first night of Pesach. Not only the miracle of the Exodus from Egypt, but that has remained throughout Jewish history as an auspicious night for miracles, for great things to happen. And there it is described to us the fall of the army of Sanherib, the fall of the army of Ashur, the terrible defeat that it suffered outside the walls. So to a certain extent, that's revenge for what happened to the northern kingdoms. But revenge is never satisfying because it doesn't bring the 10 tribes back. Killing the Demyanyuk is not really going to even the score. That's why revenge is such a difficult emotion to deal with. And because even when it's all over, one is still empty. The price has never been exacted. So, but this was the revenge of the Jewish people and of the God of Israel, so to speak, against Nineveh and against Ashur for having destroyed the northern tribes, is that they fell victim in Jerusalem to the plague and they themselves were destroyed. So now we are almost at the end of the story because we're in the year 720. We're barely 140 years from the end of the first temple. And the southern tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, even though they've been successful in this war and saved miraculously, are basically very weak and find themselves surrounded by tremendous hostile empires. And they are frightened. It is only the will of the Novi Yeshayahu that buttresses them and tells them that if they will live as a Jewish kingdom, then they'll be able to survive. We'll see, however, that they are unable to weather the storm and that the problems will set in until their own eventual demise as well.